You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Matt.
I'm a little worried about you, Bill, with this background. it's like you've been taken captive by the suits at Blogging Heads, and they've turned you into their pundit slave.
I was hoping this sort of more of a tech startup feel.
I can see that a little bit, but it looks like maybe they just throw food down once a day and you just have to churn out columns and hot takes.
You know, so we're still in remote schooling. I have my younger daughter here in my mom's place, so my daughter skips to different people's houses in a little pod. And I don't know what's going to happen. The plan was to do this through November 3rd and then do a reassessment. And the caseload, we had no cases for 3 weeks. The past week, the data just came out. We had less than five this past week. But Amherst and Holyoke, which are nearby, Holyoke borders us. Amherst is, you know, almost bordering us. They've had big clusters in the past 2 weeks. Like I think Amherst was at 95 and Holyoke was at 62. So those are big jumps. And I know my daughter's soccer is canceled for today because of that. I think because of that. It wasn't even full blown soccer. It was like socially distanced soccer, not playing games, just doing skills with your own ball and not passing to anybody.
Right.
I don't know what's going to happen, but it wouldn't be surprising if remote school gets extended. You know, and there's this whole thing that, you know, there's that Alec McGillis piece in ProPublica that Ross Douthat picked up on, that liberal cities are so anti-Trump that they're doing remote schooling and they're screwing the kids over. And there's all these inequities now, and this shows the hypocrisy of hoity-toity white liberals. And Jonathan Chait picked up on that and took a swipe at teachers' unions.
I think there's some truth there.
I mean, I'm in the quintessential liberal city, where this is happening, and I do think the teachers union has, you know, played a strong hand in the agreement that they have, but I don't think it's correct that you have this monolithic block of white liberals that just don't care about inequity and only care about their own kid. The inequity debate is very live. It was very present in the initial decision. And I think a lot of parents are just flat out conflicted. I mean, you have two liberal principles here, public safety and inequity, and they're colliding. And, you know, as much as people care about inequities, they have legitimate concerns about their own health, health of the community, teachers' health. And so you could have said a week ago, hey, no cases. You know, all the standards say you should have school now.
Yeah.
So why are you being so overly cautious? It's because you hate Trump and you care about yourself. And now you got two giant clusters nearby. You know, so
it's just a tough deal. I had a very awkward interaction, a couple of awkward interactions last night. Out here, Bill, we go to Wednesday night church.
Oh really?
Yeah.
You go twice a week or just on Wednesdays?
No, twice. Sundays and then Wednesday night.
Were you not doing that before?
Well, before COVID, I was in D.C. a lot. I was dividing my time between Alexandria, Virginia, and West Virginia. And so, when I lived in Alexandria, Virginia, going to church on a Wednesday night, because pretty much all churches have Wednesday night services, but going there would have been a major heavy lift. You know, it would have been like a 45-minute rush hour drive to get to the church I went to, which wasn't the closest church. I passed 50 churches to get to the one I went to. And on a Wednesday night, on Sunday morning, it's fine. On Wednesday night, it would have been rough, so I never did it. But here, it's awesome because they have a dinner. So it's under a tent outside. There's a dinner at 6 o'clock. And then there's like a playground where my kids love. So my kids love to go eat dinner. We're under the tent. I usually pick the table as far away from everybody as I can so I can social distance. I play on my phone. The kids eat cheeseburgers or spaghetti or whatever. Then they go to this playground with a bunch of other kids and they play. Which this is something I've just had to, you know, deal with, right? They're outside and they're kids. And that's what it is, what it is, but that's one of the risks. You know, it is what it is. And then they go to a like a Bible study for an hour, which is like, you know, sort of like a Sunday school class for kids on a Wednesday night. It's called Olympians is the name of it. I'm sure there's some controversy someone could Google about Olympians. Anyway, I do this because it gives my kids exercise, it gives them community, and it instills the values that we share. And I don't really want to do this, I'll be honest with you, mainly because of COVID. But I've been able to kind of social distance and just let them do it.
I mean, would you do it more eagerly without COVID?
Oh, totally. I would love – so one of the big downsides to this for me is – I'm sort of new to this church because I haven't been in this community even when I was living here part time. And now I can't become part of it because as an adult, I feel like it's more dangerous for me than it is for my little kids. That seems to be holding true. My kids go to a school, they go every day, and the school seems to take this stuff very seriously. The folks at my church, I'll just tell you what happened to me last night. So we got there a little bit later. I couldn't get my table way out yonder. So I had to sit a little closer to people, but it's okay. And this dude came up to me and said, like, hey, do you mind if I sit here? And I, what am I going to say, right? It's a table. There's only so many seats. And I was like, fine. And then all of a sudden, like 10 people sat down at my table. And I don't know if he could tell, like, I got to get out of here. And because apparently, Bill, I didn't realize this, but I am walking through life under the assumption that every single adult I come in contact, actually every single person I come in contact with is a carrier, is shedding virus and is about to give it. That's my default assumption.
Yeah.
And so I move to like, I get up. I try to be cool about it. I go up and my kids are in like the food line. I'm wearing a mask. Mm-hmm. At this, you know, I put on the mask.
Does everyone wear a mask?
I'm the only person last night wearing a mask.
So you're ruining yourself in this community. You're like, who's this big city guy wearing a mask?
That's the thing, Bill. I'm out. It's outside. So it's under a tent. The flaps are open. There's breeze. But I'm the only one wearing a mask. And at some point, this dude realizes that I'm like Larry David, okay? This is like the dude realizes that I've left the table and that I'm not – that I've – you know, he feels like – so he comes up and we have this big 6-foot-apart conversation now where he's apologizing and offering – he feels bad. He's a very nice guy. He's a young guy, you know, like he's an Asian-American, cosmopolitan sort of dude. This is not like – you know, an old fuddy-duddy. This is like a totally cool guy, but like seems to have no concern at all that we're in a pandemic. And meanwhile, I'm sort of like, I'm wearing my mask, having this conversation, and I'm like, I need like a 6-foot stick to like keep, you know. And I feel like a horrible friggin' person, Bill. I feel antisocial. I feel like I'm this, you know, DC guy who, you know, who's, I'm crazy. And then I'll later on, I'm wearing my mask and this like sort of older lady like walks by me and she's like, you're taking this seriously. You know, like, yes, I am. So the culture is what I'm talking about. And let me just tie it in with the politics is if you worked at the White House and your boss doesn't wear a mask and there's like a culture, it's got to be even harder for people who work in that environment day in and day out to go against the grain.
I'm a little surprised no one quit. I would think someone would be like, I'm not going to jeopardize my life for this sinking ship. You know, this guy's not going to be in office for 3 more months. I'm going to risk coronavirus just for the show of it. You know, screw that.
Yeah.
I would think, not like a mass exodus. I think somebody would say, I'm out of here. Maybe somebody will, but clearly not yet.
You would think. And then the other thing, too, is obviously like the, you know, there's pressure on political people and political staffers, but to sort of comply with the culture, the non-mask wearing culture. But then there's also, you know, what about if you're sort of like a rank and file employee, right? Or like a security person or whatever, you are sort of being put in jeopardy as well. So it is weird. And I can just tell you, like, I guess two things became apparent to me, several things. Like, one, this has really impacted my ability to build a community and to make friends in a negative way. Also, I've experienced what it's like to sort of be in a culture where wearing a mask and social distancing is it's not officially frowned upon, but just the cues and the signals are like you're weird if you're doing it, especially if you're a young, healthy person. And I am looking forward to the new year when I think we will have a vaccine. So, you know, we got to stay the course. And I'm trying, you know, we're thinking about Christmas break. Do we get on a plane and go someplace, you know? And then we get there.
We'll I think you do not, myself.
You know, my wife was essentially forced to, early, you know, a couple months, maybe like a month ago, to fly someplace for business. She wore a mask. There weren't many people on the plane. The airports were basically empty. But
even if there's like not a lot of people on a plane, I would still feel like the people who are on the plane are probably the biggest numbnuts. So I would not trust that air is not circulating into me.
Well, it also just occurred to me. I am going through. You remember how Trump says, like, don't let this dominate you. I don't live in fear. Like, I'm perfectly happy, and most of my life, Bill, you know, it's like I've been training for this my whole life. I'm a writer, and I live in the country, and I got a deck, and I sit out and read, and but for the sake of my kids, for like their mental health and their well-being, I went, you know, I'm going to these things, and I feel pretty safe for them. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Just because I feel like the science is on my side on this one, knock on wood. But I am going to, it just occurred to me for the first time that, like, I am going through life with the assumption that every person I come in contact with is could kill me.
That's not a reasonable way to go about doing it.
I think it's probably the safest assumption, right?
Right. Well, I could talk about, you know, our COVID-infected lives all day, but we should talk about the debate.
That would have been a great TBS show or something, or like after-school special.
I'm sure the amount of COVID-related, you know, content coming our way is going to suffocate.
Because it's the morning after the debate, several people commented on how bad I looked. I think it was last week or 2 weeks ago. After the last debate, people were commenting on how wrecked I look. Let the record state it's not just women that people comment on their appearance. It's me too, and I'm likewise. If you see me drinking a venti Starbucks, it's because we're doing this the morning after a debate.
Well, you know, Matt, I'm doing these YouTube commentaries now. I'm trying to build up a YouTube base. YouTube is potentially
what are they called?
YouTube. Oh, shareable. Yes.
Shareable.
The shareable series on YouTube. And you got to produce a lot of content if you're going to be eligible for advertising. And so I just need to just do it when I can do it. And I can't wait till I look halfway decent, which is pretty rare as it is. So if I'm disheveled and I'm home or I'm in the basement or wherever and I got 20 minutes, I just got to do it. And yeah. So every time I'm doing it through live chats, and people are coming on saying, "Whoa, Mountain Man, you know, gotta get to the barbershop."
I don't know. I feel like I don't know when this is going to be, but at some point, because look, if you're AOC, if you're a young lady, you can just sort of do you know, just turn your iPhone around and do a live stream and you look good and people, you know, are gonna watch probably. You hit a certain age as a dude, especially when radio may be a better medium. And I feel like the key, and I don't know when this is going to be, when we give up. Like, at some point, do you quit trying and just go Hemingway? You know what I mean? Like, go the other direction and just be like, own it and be like, I'm just going to be Ernest Hemingway
I'm kind of there, Matt. But
be eccentric.
So, debate. I mean, I did a little preview earlier where I thought this wasn't going to change anything in the presidential, no matter what happens. But it's relevant to any potential 2024 action is concerned. Whether it's 2020 or 2024 or 2028, if you will, do you think what happened last night has any import?
No, I don't think so. It's not a popular thing to say. You're not really allowed to say that on, like, cable news, probably, but I don't think it's going to matter. I think that the only thing that mattered is that nothing happened to change the trajectory of the race, right? I mean, if Mike Pence had a great moment, if Kamala Harris had a bad, like, had looked weak or stumbled, then it might have mattered on the margins. I think that, you know, Pence was essentially on defense most of the night, but there wasn't any nothing really changed the state of the race, which is that Donald Trump appears, by all the metrics we have, if we believe all the metrics, right, Donald Trump appears to be losing. And I don't think anything that happened last night changes that.
Well, I agree with that. I do think it has relevance to 2024, assuming Trump loses and assuming Biden doesn't run again, which, you know, neither things are, you know, are certainly true, but I think they're both plausible outcomes. I think both had dual agendas. They had to be loyal to their presidential nominees, but they also had to establish their own personas. And I think they both achieved what they wanted to achieve in that regard. Pence was the Trump loyalist who is more civil and not as belligerent as Trump is. So he could still potentially be the guy who stuck by Trump even when things were bad, but would be a different character. So you could think about
gentler Trumpism.
Yeah.
And you like Trump, but you don't like the tweets. You don't like the mean rhetoric. I'm your guy. By the way, let me say, you talked about the loyalist thing. One interesting little note there. Pence is normally more obsequious. I mean, he normally talks about, and I'm standing on the broad shoulders of Donald Trump. He didn't do that. And that makes me wonder if he is seeing the writing on the wall that Trump is going down.
Yeah. And that last question, the one written by the 8-year-old about civility, I don't think Pence mentioned Trump's name in that answer. I mean, obviously it would have been ridiculous to your ears and mine, but he still might have said, you know, as Donald Trump always does, you know, he may be, you know, a strong, powerful voice, but he always hears both sides and he has brought
Kamala
both sides to the table. Yeah. Kamala talked very much about Joe Biden in that answer.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Kamala's performance is up until this point, her role in that partnership has to lean more left than Biden. She has spoken with more resistance-friendly language. She has played up the fact at the convention in her acceptance speech, she played up that she is the child of two Berkeley civil rights activists. She didn't do any of that last night. She was squarely in Biden's moderate bipartisan unity frame. When she talked about her mother, she talked about the immigrant experience and then said that Joe Biden and her were raised with similar values. This is the first appearance she has done. I mean, she's been doing a ton of debates, has been the public eye, but in front of a basically Democratic audience. This is the first audience she's had that is of broader ideological diversity, and she adjusted for it. This is the beginning of her saying, I'm going to introduce yourself to a new audience and saying, I am in the Biden mold and can be a unifying figure in my own right.
I think the most important thing she did in that regard was her demeanor, which was generally she smiled more. I mean, people, you know,
she's always been a smiler. She's always been a happy warrior.
She has a charming side. And so does Pence. But Pence didn't do it last night.
Yeah.
Pence didn't smile. You know, Pence can do the Reagan, all shucks, I'm a happy warrior thing. He was very serious.
Not as good as Reagan.
What's that?
He never was as good as Reagan.
No, of course not. But he does a Reagan and Pence. Basically, if Reagan and George W. Bush had a love child, it would be Mike Pence. I mean, Pence is basically doing an impersonation of Reagan and George W. Bush. That's kind of how I see it. Mm-hmm. And Reagan had that likable, smiley side. He could also be tough. Reagan's one of the few politicians, Bill Clinton too, who could equally do optimism and cheeriness and indignation. Most politicians can do one or the other. Reagan could do both. I think Pence generally can do both. But last night, Pence didn't do that. Pence, you didn't really see Pence smile. I think Kamala was much better at that. But I also think she dodged a bunch of questions. They both did. I wrote about her dodging questions at The Beast. But I think that the part where she talked about how like she and Biden are similar, it just didn't, it felt forced to me. Like it lacked verisimilitude in my opinion. Like, yeah, Biden and I had a similar childhood. Right.
Well, this is interesting because, I mean, I'm sure that to the average conservative ear, you know, I mean, I see most conservatives look at Kamala as more of a partisan, harder-edged ideological figure, whereas the hard-edged socialists look at Kamala as a cop and a phony and an establishment figure. And the broad middle of the country doesn't know much about her at all yet. So I can't say, you know, I can't put myself in the shoes of, you know, a more passive middle of the road voter and how they interpreted Kamala last night. It's very possible that it wasn't a magical moment where they have fallen in love with her instantaneously. But assuming she's vice president, she's going to have at least 4 years to try to build that up. I mean, there's this whole question of, you know, there was a Frank Luntz focus group where the Pence characterizations were much more nice than the Kamala characterizations. I think the CNN focus group was more even Steven. But there is this, you know, looming question out there. How much is she going to be judged by a double standard on gender and on race? And I think the way she gets over that hump is by being in the public eye for 4 years and building that comfort level and building that familiarity. So I don't know if it works like magic on day one, but I think it's the beginning of her journey to try to do that.
Yeah, look, again, I mean, I think Kamala, again, both people dodged a lot of questions. I think Kamala, you know, just didn't answer a lot of the questions.
Well, let's talk court packing. I mean, that's the big one, right?
Well, that one bothers me, yeah. And we disagree on this, but I think that you owe it to the public to answer this question. This is a serious question that has to do with democratic norms. Biden and Harris are ostensibly running to be the antidote to Trumpism, right? And so part of that would be, let's be honest about things, which they're not really being. And part of it would be, let's have a return to normalcy. So I feel like you owe it to the public to say one way or the other what you're going to do on this big issue.
But the fact that she didn't, I mean, she was pressed on it repeatedly.
Yeah.
And with a big smile on her face, she gave absolutely no ground, no hint, nothing. I mean, that's a decision.
You're right, and that's why I wrote about it at The Beast, because she is making a conscious decision to refuse.
She and Biden. I mean, she's following Biden's lead on this because Biden laid out that standard earlier, saying I am not going to answer that question because it's going to change the subject, and the subject should be.
And the question wasn't the moderator. Didn't this was a question asked by Mike Pence.
Yep.
Pence was on defense all night. If Pence is talking about COVID for a half hour, he's losing.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what he says. He could be as eloquent as hell. If that's the topic, he's losing. The only time Pence wasn't on defense was when he brought up a topic. And one of the topics he brought up, one of the questions he asked was about cord packing. And I think that it would have been appropriate for the moderator to press her to answer that question.
Well, I want to stay on the cord packing subject, but I think she made a choice, the moderator, Susan Page, to not do follow-ups. People were saying that Chris Wallace let the debate slip away from him. He was a much more aggressive moderator in following up, more so than almost any moderator in the last 20 years. She was a more traditional moderator. I just want you to follow the 2-minute rule, and that's the end of my involvement.
This is my problem. I don't want to go off on a tangent here, Bill, but look, I understand they negotiate all this and there's deals and promises and agreements, but as an interviewer, I'm not a great interviewer, but I've been doing a podcast for over a decade, probably like a dozen years. I've been doing a podcast way before podcasts had their moment. I've been interviewing people and I've learned, and if you may have like a list of 20 questions that you'd like to ask, but if you get into a good conversation with somebody about something and they don't quite answer it, or you think that you should linger there, you should forget the other questions and stick with, if it's important enough, just stay there. And I think that, you know, these moderators are like, time to move on to the, we got to talk about climate change now. And it's like, well, we didn't really get, I think these candidates have more interesting things to say about this. And I haven't been satisfied with their answer yet. But they're just so beholden to the schedule and making sure they check off every question or every topic that they said they were going to talk about. And I understand, again, with the agreement, but it doesn't help the voter, I think.
Well, I think the Wallace debate was much better on this score. We saw who the candidates were. It was to Trump's great disadvantage to have everybody see what he was. Forcing them off of the scripted talking points, it was a better debate. But I want to get back to the court packing, though.
Okay.
Why would it be that you wouldn't answer it? So Pence filled in the blank himself from their perspective. They have a secret plan to pack the core. They won't be honest with you about it.
That's one option.
That's their line. They're going to stick to that. I don't think that squares. It's hard. I mean, if you're actually going to pack the court, that's not so easy. And you'd have to not just say it yourself. You have to get 50 senators to come along. If you won't say it, it's probably because it's unpopular. If you want to do it, but you won't say it, it's because it's unpopular and saying it would be bad for you. And if it's unpopular, then it's going to be hard to get 50 senators to agree because they're not all from deep blue places. You'd have to get some moderate senators even to get to 50. If you can't build public will around it because you're afraid to even say it in a debate, that says at minimum, if you want to do it, you got some work to do to get there. And it's not going to happen right away. So I don't buy that they've made a decision to do it and they're hiding the ball. At the same time, Kamala Harris was very eager to say, we are not banning fracking. I don't care what this guy says. We are not banning fracking. Oh, we are not raising taxes on people under $400,000. I don't care what this guy says. Whereas she was happy to kind of let it sit there on cord packing. So let's look at what Biden said on the subject. You know, before Amy Coney Barrett, he was explicitly against cord packing, firmly against it. And that's not just a position he took out of the blue. He has been for bipartisanship, for compromise and collaboration on judicial nominations going back to 1992. Now, he was for the nuclear option in 2013 after the blockade on the D.C. circuit, or at least he said publicly, you know, maybe we have to do that. He indicated support for that. I'm not 100% sure if he said something publicly after it happened. But he gave the signal shortly before it did happen. So that to me indicates, I mean, and let's also keep in mind on was Monday or Tuesday that he gave the Gettysburg speech and leaned into bipartisanship. It wasn't just, I mean, I tweeted out and some people were like, oh, this is just standard campaign rhetoric. I'm like, well, look at the full speech. He's leaning in. You know, we can't, you know, be a country if we look at the other parties, if there are enemies. I know people say I'm naive about this, but we can do this and we need to do this. Like, I don't think that's just regular campaign rhetoric. So I don't think you can separate that out of the court packing question. But by the same token, he's not ruling it out. He's not going out of his way at this moment to say, no way, no how am I going to do that? So I think there's two reasons for him to make that calculation. One, a lot of Democrats do want to do it. So by taking the firm position, you're now introducing a position that divides your own party and separates your base from the swing. Why do that when you're leading by double digits in several polls a month before Election Day? So you want to avoid saying that controversial. Number two, if in his heart of hearts he doesn't want to do it, it's very useful leverage to have it in your back pocket and say, you know, hey, Grassley, hey, Romney, hey, Ben Sasse, you know, I don't want to do this. You know, I don't want to do this. I want us to get along.
You're describing extortion.
I'm describing negotiation.
One man's negotiation is another man's extortion.
So, you know, I
don't want to have to kill this puppy, Bill, but I will.
I tweeted out an anecdote that Biden told that was published in GQ in 2006. It's the corn pop story. But when he's told the corn pop story, recently, it's been a story about, you know, racial reconciliation. When he told it in 2006, he talks about how, you know, the people at the pool were not following the rules. He called Corn Pop by his given name, Esther, which was insulting to him. After the group left, they were waiting for Biden with razor blades. And Biden saw this. He talks to the maintenance man. The maintenance says, here's a 6-foot chain, wrap it around your arm and put a towel around it so you can protect yourself. And so Biden goes out there like that, but he says he doesn't call attention to the chain. He goes out and says, hey, I'm sorry I called you Esther. That was out of line. And Corn Pop says, you apologized. Forget it. They go home. And so Biden says the moral of the story is you got to be prepared to use the chain, but there are other ways.
Yeah.
So I think Biden is perfectly happy to have the threat in the back pocket. And there's no reason to take it off the table right now. But I don't think it's correct to assume this means like he wants to do it. He's planning to do it. It's right on the verge of doing it. So that's how I interpret everything that happened last night.
So, I mean, all the things you say make sense from Biden's standpoint. I understand why he would do it. I would say three things. One, so I agree. I don't think Biden is going to show up on day one and say, we're going to blow up we're going to nuke the filibuster, the legislative filibuster, and we're going to and we're going to pack the courts. Like, I don't think that's how it works. I think that what they need a pretext, right? So if this happens, it's going to be because of gridlock, right? They're going to try to do something. Republicans are going to stop it. And then they're going to say, you guys are not playing fair. Therefore, we are going to go nuclear, right?
You have to go nuclear first before you could pack the court.
Yeah. So that's sort of number one. I don't think that I don't think that excuses Biden from what he's doing. And I would say two more things. One, I would be more understanding if they were being vague about taxes or fracking, right? I mean, these are important issues, but these are like public policy questions. The question of packing the court has to do with democratic norms. And so I put it in the same category, maybe not quite as bad, but I would put it in the same category as like Trump and Pence refusing to say like whether they would support the peaceful transfer of power. Like, I understand why Trump doesn't want to say that. He doesn't, in Trump's mind, he doesn't want to show any sign of weakness or any sign of doubt or entertain the possibility that he might even lose. And furthermore, he thinks that the only way, if he loses, the only way it could possibly happen is if there's voter fraud, right? So in his warped mind, I understand why he doesn't. But because I understand why he doesn't want to do it, doesn't mean I think it's smart or virtuous. I think it's actually destructive. I think it's harmful for democracy. And I think that voters have a right to kind of know where people stand on these issues. And then the last point I would make is, remember, I mean, I don't want to like compare these two things exactly, but remember like when John McCain, during that town hall meeting where the woman called Obama a Muslim and an Arab or something, mm-hmm. and John McCain was like, no, ma'am. Yep. He's a decent, you know. Okay, that was John McCain doing the right thing, even though it kind of hurt him with his base. I mean, it's disturbing that the Republican base would be turned off by what John McCain did. But what John McCain did was an act of heroism, of doing something, of being a leader, of saying the right thing to calm the nation and to set an example, even though it probably was a wedge issue that hurt him with his base. So what I'm calling upon Joe Biden to do is to be better than Trump. It's to be more than just a politician who panders to his base. It's to do what a real leader ought to do, which is to be willing to say something for the good of the country that may not be politically expedient in the short term.
Well, I mean, you're right that, you know, voters have a right to know. Reporters have the right to ask the question. His opponents have the right to criticize him for not answering it. I mean, that's all fair. But a voter, he's not the first politician to evade a question on some matter, and a voter has a right to factor that into his or her decision making.
I would add one caveat, Bill. I think the media needs to do a better job. Like, Susan Page didn't even ask the question. I don't know if she would have. I don't think she would have if Pence did.
I think Biden gets asked again at some point, probably more than once between now and Election Day.
There's a sense with the media that because Trump and Pence are so egregious, and they are, we're not going to push Biden and Harris as much. We're going to give them a little bit of a pass, and I think that's a mistake.
Well, I want to make one other point here, which is what constitutes being a leader in this circumstance. I think Biden is sticking his neck out to say we need to restore bipartisanship. And I think it is an imperative to actually do that. I mean, I think if we descend deeper into polarization, that's going to be very bad. If we get to the point where we are nuking the filibuster and packing the court and eroding institutions and having tyranny of the majority government, I think that is deeply destructive to the structure as the founders intended it. To get that bipartisanship is not a simple matter. It's not going to fall into his lap, even if he wins by a large margin. So I think it is laudable, assuming that, you know, Biden's thinking is where my thinking is at, to say, I'm going to go the extra mile here to extract that bipartisanship. I need to find a way to move these guys and tell them, you need to put the country first. And if mm-hmm. you don't, this is what happens. I can't hold these guys off forever. I think he has legitimate reasons in this particular case to
If you go back to the Chris Wallace debate, Biden's answer was basically like, I can't say because you'll make it they'll use it against me as a political. I'm like, you can say that about any tough question. I'm not going to answer because it could hurt me. Mm-hmm. Like, is that a legitimate answer?
Well, say Wallace, it like that, of course.
Chris Wallace moved on. Do you want to know why? Gotta go to the next topic. gotta talk about something else.
One thing Biden could say, it does lean a bit. If he's getting pressed and he feels like it's just not tenable to give the same non-answer every single time, he could kind of brush off and say, I've answered this question before, but I'm not going to get into it now because this is the matter at hand, which is true. He has answered this before. He's just not repeating himself. And it's a way to point to his past opposition without verbalizing it explicitly and having that in a quote to be on TV and to be in the newspapers.
That would be a smarter one, because if I heard that, I would think, okay, he's not going to pack the court, or at least he's saying he's not going to, which is something. But a progressive, it wouldn't be as, you know, damaging, or it wouldn't be as frustrating for them. Probably. Right.
And Biden has cracked the door open on nuclear option. He said something over the summer was, we have to see how obstructionist or something like that the Republicans are being. And you know, this is the question, mate. I think, go back to what you're saying before, I don't think they can do it on day one. I think some people want to do it on day one. They think that you want to preempt what the Supreme Court might do once Barrett is on there. But I don't think Biden wants to do that. I don't think they have the votes to do that. I think they need the pretext.
Joe Manchin's not going to.
Well, Manchin,
Joe Manchin's not going to be for this.
But it's folks like the people who are coming in, Hickenlooper, potentially Ossoff or Boulier, or I think Bullock is more a norm buster. Bullock, you might have. Teresa Greenfield, you don't know. If Kel Cunningham can survive, he said flat out he's not for eliminating the filibuster. Jamie Harrison said, I'm a no at this point on eliminating the filibuster. Those guys are not day one people. John Tester's not a day one person. Dianne Feinstein's not a day one person. But if you, the first order of business, presumably, is an economic relief package. Even if somehow they pull off a compromise now, I doubt it's going to be all that robust. If they did do a robust one, maybe not. If they don't, that's the number one priority.
That's a good move for Biden.
I just want to say one more thing here. If Republicans don't let him save the economy, if he can't get 5, 6, 7, 8, whatever number they need on that, that is going to drive Democrats up the wall.
It could happen, Bill, because all of a sudden they're going to rediscover fiscal conservatism and worries about the debt and the deficit, and they're going to have incentives to go back to being Tea Party, Tea Partiers who care about debt. But
on the flip side, if Biden can find those votes, which they did in 2009, they only needed 3 at that point, not more. But if Biden can find them, that saps a lot of energy out of the nuclear option push and the core packing push.
Yeah. Well, and maybe there's some sort of big, I'll sound, Pollyanna here, but there should be, I think you and I would probably agree, ideally, there would be, like a constitutional amendment or at least an agreement. We need to have a set number of judges. It should probably be an odd number for obvious reasons. Maybe it's 11. We've had 9 for 150 years. That seems like a pretty good precedent. It seems like a pretty well-established norm. But we need to have an established number so that the game, we're playing by the same rules. And I would be, I would certainly entertain the idea of having term limits. Like somebody has proposed the 18-year term limit. Maybe there should be an age, too. You have to be 45 or something, 40 to be a Supreme Court justice, 35 as the president, right? Because the only problem I have with the term limit is I don't want justices thinking about their next job. You know what I mean? Like I'm doing this for 18 years and then I'm going to parlay that into something else. You don't want that. But here's what I don't like about our current system now. We have become embroiled in controversy because Scalia died at a time where we had no idea, and RBG died at a very inopportune time for democracy. I just don't think that's a good way to run a railroad, is to have this contingent on, if someone dies now instead of 3 months from now, you know what I mean? Or 4 months from now. I think that fundamentally we need to settle on a number of justices, and if we need to do some reforms, I'd be open to that idea.
But any attempt at reform. I mean, there's certain reforms. I mean, you can change the number without a constitutional amendment. To fix the number, you would need a constitutional amendment.
Right.
To do term limits, you would need a constitutional amendment. Any constitutional amendment would require very broad bipartisan support. And how are you ever going to get that on the court, or for that matter, the Electoral College, or for adding states? You can only do any of these things if both sides think neither side's getting an edge over this. I mean, usually when we used to talk about DC statehood, it was always talked about in partnership, in pairing with some other statehood tweak that would benefit Republicans initially, so it would be even Steven. And now
that's
it's
basically how it's always worked.
Right. Not in Texas. not back in the Missouri Compromise, 1850 Compromise days. That got skewed very quickly.
Saying, like, generally speaking, even going back to, you know, it would be like one northern state and one southern state, or like the last two were Hawaii.
That was the Missouri Compromise period.
Hawaii was the state, right? And the last was the Democrat state.
Yeah. So, I mean, most procedural reforms I'm fine with, and some I'm actively in favor of, so long as you can do it through bipartisan means. You know, people in D.C. and Puerto Rico should be enfranchised. But you got to do it in a way that doesn't, you know, cause such ire on the other side that they reciprocate in some awful way as soon as they get the chance. And I just don't see it happening with anything court related, because
here's the thing, Bill. Maybe Joe Biden is going to use the here's the one. Maybe I'm wrong. If Joe Biden uses this threat of court packing to push a truly fair agreement, you know, which is like, we are going to agree, whatever. I mean, you know, do we want to establish the idea that a president can't make a nomination during his third during an election year? Like, I don't think that's a good idea. But if we want to have a consistent standard, then okay, I mean, whatever they want, let's make a deal.
Let's shift gears to the the Commission on Presidential Debates deciding to go virtual for the next town hall debate.
Yeah.
And then Donald Trump immediately saying, you know, can't change the rules on this. They're doing this because I won the first debate. And the commission's now,
and because that Fox News moderator was so liberally biased.
Well, look, last I checked, which was pretty late last night, in the Real Clear Politics average, Biden has expanded his lead by 3.6 points in the 1 week since the debate.
Wow.
And that is, you know, most of that poll data is before the diagnosis or in the midst of the diagnosis. So you can't even say it's because people are freaked out by the helicopter trip home or anything, because that's not really part of the data that we've gotten so far. So I think it's primarily debate reaction. So it's really hard to argue this is because Trump won the debate, because that was one of the I mean, we've mentioned in the past, you know, first debates for incumbents often go bad. Obama's was pretty bad. Obama actually lost a small lead and had a small deficit afterwards. But this was pretty bad in the annals of, you know, first debates for incumbents.
And you had the Rose Garden thing and all that, and the super spreader events and the but look, I mean, I understand why Trump doesn't want to do this. It's pretty obvious, right? Number one, it's a reminder that things are not normal, that COVID's a problem, and that he mishandled the COVID response. And so just by virtue of doing it, he loses. I mean, I talked about how Mike Pence was on defense all night. This would be just symbolically the shot of them being in different locations is a weird thing, unusual. Hasn't happened since 1960. The third debate, Nixon Kennedy. Check out my podcast with David Petruja about that. So that's number one. And number two, Trump needs a game-changing moment. And I think he thinks that the way that happens is if Joe Biden has a major meltdown or a gaffe or just loses his train of thought. And it's less likely that that happens if they're in different studios and it's, okay, Mr. Biden or Vice President Biden, you have 2 minutes uninterrupted, and we're going to, like, cut off Trump's mic and let you actually speak. So I get what – I mean, I get why Trump wants to – you know, doesn't like this. Now, you never know with Trump, though. Is this just a negotiation ploy? Is he really going to not show up? I'm skeptical.
I think he's really not going to show up. I mean, beyond all things that you've said, which I basically agree with, they are really leaning into how strong Trump is in the face of this virus. Yeah. You have to look this virus in the eye and stare it down and wrangle it to the ground and to say, hey, people can't be around you, Trump, so much so that we have to change the rules of the debate. That undercuts all of that messaging. They're talking about doing rallies.
Yeah. Let me just ask a serious question. Isn't it totally possible that by the next debate's Thursday night? So isn't it totally possible that Trump could be that he would be safe by then, especially if we're doing, you know, 10 feet apart and plexiglass? Like, do we really need to do virtual?
I mean, I'm not the doctor here. I mean, if a independent doctor, not the people currently treating him, not the people on the government payroll,
the doctor from The Simpsons,
right? Yeah. If a doctor said, hey, I examined him, we've tested him, He's symptom free. He's testing negative. There's no chance of contagion. This is okay. I'd accept that. My understanding of people who have had COVID, it's not that short a time frame where you are not contagious. So I certainly wouldn't assume that would be the case at this juncture. And the commission has to make a decision. If it's going to be a virtual debate, they have to plan for that. So it's clearly recourse.
Since you said at this juncture, I'll say it sounds prudent. Sounds prudent to do it this way. I'm just being devil's advocate, contrarian here. But look, I get why Trump doesn't want to do it.
Biden could not do an in person one. Biden could not put himself at risk. I mean, for his own personal safety, and it would be fundamentally irresponsible to put himself at risk. It would destroy the election if he got sick. If he got sick and actually died, I mean, that would be a constitutional disaster.
That would not be good. That would not be optimal. I agree. Although you maybe get President Kamala. But
the process of getting her on the ballot and the Electoral College, I mean, it would be a total cluster.
And just think of what conservatives and Republicans, I mean, the conspiracy theories. I don't even want to go there with what the conspiracy theories would be. But it would be, I think you can see where this is going.
Yeah.
My take is, again, we're recording this. I think it's Thursday morning.
Yeah,
I think I'm not my sharpest. But as of Thursday morning, 10:27 a.m. Eastern time from my undisclosed location, I think Trump does it virtual because he loves attention. I think he doesn't have the moral high ground here. You know, he loses that argument over fairness and appropriateness and prudence, right? And I think they're going to let Joe Biden just have an hour and a half by himself, right?
I think that's a question. Does the commission say, we're doing this debate, be here at this time. If you're not there, too bad for you. I mean, they may do it that way. I'm not sure if they will, but I think that's only possible.
I think that's what they should do, by the way. I mean, I think that's part of why Trump has gotten to do what Trump does is that people have not stood up to him and not stuck by their guns. And I think the commission should say, you know, this is happening and you can either be there or not. But, you know, I mean, that's on you. We're doing it.
Now, I've said since 2016 that Trump would do debates. I never bought the notion that he was going to quit, that he would be scared or any of that kind of stuff. This guy likes attention way too much, more than any human being in world history. And debates are some of the biggest TV ratings you could ever possibly get. He can't walk Yep. away from that kind of spectacle. I do think this is different because doing it is a tacit admission that he is in a weakened, dangerous state. And that is antithetical to the message he wants to put out to the public.
I think that's true. And you know, obviously we agree. But here's another factor, too. Could Trump do an interview in front of a camera? Or, like, could Trump do a debate, like, logistically? You know what I mean? Like, I feel like Biden could debate in front of a camera in a room by himself better. It just – Trump wants to be in the mix. He wants to be walking around and like – I just – it not only is it like symbolically and optically bad for Trump, but it also it's not – has he done anything like that before?
I can't – I'm trying to think, has he done a virtual thing? I can't think of one. Has he done a Zoom type event?
Biden's done a lot of Zoom,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah. I mean it kind of contains you. It kind of shrinks you. You don't command a room. You're not standing tall in front of a podium. I mean, he does stuff at his desk sometimes.
It's a bit of an equalizer. Yeah. I mean, you know, it could be good if you're – I mean, it could be good if you're Biden probably.
But even those logistical things I don't think are the main thing. I mean, it's just doing it says, yes, I'm sick. Yes, I'm making the people around – I'm putting the people around me in danger, and they have to quarantine me to do this event. I just don't think he wants to accept any of that.
Well, he also feeds off of the energy of a room, of the crowd. That's going to be gone, you know? So it's bad for so many reasons, but I just don't think he can turn down. I don't think he can not do it. And he lies all the time. He says we're not doing the stimulus deal with Pelosi. We'll after I win, and then 15 minutes later, he tweets out, "Hey, we're still open for a deal." I mean, how long is it going to be before he reverses this decision too? I don't have any confidence in his word.
He can always reverse himself. I mean, his word means nothing. I think he has reasons to not do this debate that I think go beyond just his general inability to be consistent. Now, the stimulus is an interesting question because I think he has huge incentive to get right with Pelosi on stimulus.
That's true.
He should want to have checks in the mail. But I think he has played this so badly. I mean, what would be hard for Pelosi would be for Trump to put a legitimate deal on the table. So for Pelosi and Democrats to refuse it would be seen as transparently political. That's a squeeze on Pelosi. But Trump only puts stuff on the table that are 100% self-serving and is completely inconsistent about his own negotiating position. It's so much easier for Pelosi to say, this isn't a real deal. I can't trust this guy. Yeah. This is not
it's
on the level.
What a bad negotiator he is, considering the reputation that he had fostered going in. I mean, into the presidency.
I mean, the thing that Trump is hung up on and the Republicans are hung up on seems to be like they're happy to give people checks in the mail. They don't care about conservative principles or fiscal conservatism when it comes to just giving people money directly. They don't want to give money to the states. That's their tripwire.
Well, I'm sure there's money. I mean, I'm sure there's money going to like unions and all sorts of feathering the nests of all sorts of progressive causes. And if I were to do a deep dive, which I won't do, into one of these spending bills, I'm sure you could find lots of progressive, money being spent.
But nevertheless, that seems like their gap between $1.6 trillion and $2.4 trillion is state bailout money.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is, Bill, like, he needs a game changer. Why wouldn't you do this politically, right?
He should do it. And they should suck up money to the states.
I don't know how many days we have left between now and the election, but they're not a lot. Not many days, right? And if you think about, like, what were the game changers? What were the black swan? What could happen? Well, a Supreme Court justice opening was, like, a really weird October surprise that you could have thought unlikely, but it would really change things. They got that, and he's still, you know, for a variety of reasons, it's not really helping Trump. You know, a vaccine. Well, you could have always thought maybe there's going to be a vaccine. We're not going to have a vaccine by Election Day. Not one that
Matt,
I would take.
It's momentarily. It's coming momentarily.
But I think it's imminent. But he's not going to have that October surprise of like, we got it. You know, you go down the list. He's running out of things he could do that might change things.
I mean, I think the stimulus was the last thing.
And the debates what are the things that could change the trajectory?
The hope for the debates was that Biden would tank it, and he didn't. Yeah. So that's already lost. The last thing left was stimulus. Now, I mean, the thing that Trump wanted earlier in the year was for there to be a feeling that things were getting better. The economy's opening up. We're getting past the virus. It's all going to be okay. And we're having more layoffs and coronavirus spikes, so much so that it actually reaches the White House. Everything he wanted to happen in October is going the total opposite direction.
It's hard to pretend that things are okay and that COVID isn't real when you have it yourself and you can't actually do a real live debate.
That's why Pence was had a bad hand in the debate, having it so much to be about COVID, but to say their plan worked was, you know, it just doesn't, it does not pass the basic sanity test. I think, as I've always said, chaos is bad for the incumbent. This continues to feel chaotic. It does not feel like we're getting a handle on it, that we're on a path to success. It feels unsettling. It feels disorienting. People still don't know what's going to happen day to day. That is the absolute worst place for Trump to be in. And having a chaotic debate performance, I think, brought that home to a new class of people. People who are leaning Republican to the point where they're saying, I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah. Well, let me end on some shameless promotion for us, Bill. Number one, I think people should, and let me just say, I used to call this, it's going to hurt our relationship. I used to call you up or text you to get your take on things. Now I just go to YouTube and I watch Shareable. And instead of brainstorming over the phone, I just listen to you tell me. So I would recommend it. Everyone subscribe to your Shareable, Share Able. You know, is it pretty much, how often are you doing this a week?
I'm trying to do two or three a week. It's when I can, find the time. I mean, but just to be, candid, to make money doing this, you got to get the subscribers and have enough public watch hours. So you got to hit 1,000 subscribers and get 4,000 watch hours in a year.
Where are you now? You're at like, 400 or something, 350?
I think 360 something on subscribers.
And so you're getting, this is like a pledge drive.
It is.
It's a nonstop
pledge drive.
It doesn't cost you any. It's not even a pledge. It doesn't cost you anything to subscribe. So do it. Watch. These are great. Again, I think it is impacting my, our relationship, because I just watch videos now to know what you think. The other thing is, support this sort of long form discussion, and you're working on a podcast project. I have this podcast, and so on Patreon. If you like Bill, support him. Is it patreon.com/BillShare? Mine is patreon.com/MattLewis. And then you are invited to our weekly DM Zooms, where it's not just Bill and Matt, kibitzing, but we bring you in. It's a, it's a pretty small group. And eventually maybe we have to have multiple of these to keep the vibe going. But it's super fun. And I learn, we've made some good friends and people from all over, not just the country, all over the world.
It's not about the money, Matt. It's about the friends we've made along the way.
I think we can agree on that. But the money's important, too. Because you know why? You can't change the world if you can't pay the rent.
There's a total random thought there. There's this really great GOTV video that was done with African-American Atlanta strippers. And it's really fantastic. It's get your booty to the pole if you Google that. And there's one woman that says, can't make it, because the whole thing is about you get to elect your DAs.
I want to make sure my VPN is turned on before I do that. But get your booty to the polls. Yeah. Okay.
So they talk a lot about how you have the power to vote for your local district.
Is district that a fly?
I think it was.
What are the odds?
And so this one woman with swim stripper, and it says, can't make it rain if you're locked up on some bullshit. I just thought that is just a perfect get out the vote line. So anyway,
I'm fine with that. I'll tell you what I'm not fine with: these celebrity music videos about voting. Like, let me just a message to Sarah Silverman and all the celebrities who hate Donald Trump: the best way you can help defeat him is to be quiet for the next month.
I still love, do not
urge us, Taylor Swift. Do not urge us to vote. Do not. I don't want.
Now you're messing with Taylor, Matt. That's crossing the line. Can't mess with Taylor. Number one.
I'm a fan of her entire catalog. When you say Tim McGraw, I go back to the country stuff. Teardrops on my. It's all good. But it was not good for Biden. That's the thing.
Well, I still think it didn't work, obviously, but I still love the Robert Downey Jr. Save the Day video from 2016. That was just really because they were making fun of themselves. It wasn't haughty celebrity PSA. It was self-deprecating celebrity PSA. I thought it worked. But I want to plug one other thing before we go. I have a piece in Real Clear Politics earlier this week. Democrats may be gaining the Electoral College edge. I think we're seeing demographic shifts happening in Arizona. We're seeing it in the Southeast. We're seeing it in South Carolina. The fact that Jamie Harrison is running neck and neck with Lindsey Graham, I think,
that's
is
amazing.
I mean, this is a thing where if I got one thing wrong this year, is that for a long time this summer, I said, don't give money to Jamie Harrison. He's getting all this money, and this is one of the least competitive races. Give it to Barbara Bullier. Give it to MJ Hagar. Give it to Teresa Greenfield. Give it to Steve Bullock. But that money did make a difference, I think, for Harrison. I think it's still making a difference. And what I did not appreciate was how rapidly South Carolina is demographically shifting. It's the fifth highest number of out-of-state migration in the country.
Good weather.
So I think those college-educated suburbanites that are leaning away from Republicans now.
Too, man.
Well, I mean, but like Texas, we knew.
Rick Perry imported all sorts of. he would go to California and try to steal.
That's a fantastic point, man. That's a fantastic point.
It happened, and the people he brought in they're not like hard left progressives, but they're just sort of like cosmopolitan suburban folk who don't like Trump. And he imported them to Texas, and now there was going to be immigration. Texas is a Texas is a business friendly state, and it's got nice weather, and it's got cool barbecue, and there's a lot to recommend it, as you and I both know, Bill. But this isn't just organic. Like Rick Perry, brought in huge businesses, from California with hundreds or thousands of workers. Anyway, interesting.
So I think that's happening in South Carolina now. Again, I'm not saying it's a given that Harrison's going to win, but the notion that demographics is destiny, Democrats overplayed earlier. They thought they were on a glide path, and they pressed the culture issues too far. And Obama had a more narrow win in 2012, and that tipped completely in the Electoral College of 2016. Biden is getting the advantage of the demographic shifts while also getting more of that white working class vote because he's playing it light on culture issues.
Well, you shouldn't go around telling people, hey, man, we're the what was the nomenclature there about the rising, the ascendant, right? The coalition of the ascendant.
Right.
And we are going to. That leads to you will not replace us. You know what I mean? So Biden is smarter probably about downplaying it. But look, let me just say one of the funniest, it's a crazy year. And there's even as scary as times are, there's some funny stuff. And I feel like one of my favorite genres of humor here is the Lindsey Graham. They're destroying me, you know.
Yeah.
They're killing me. You got to help me, Almighty.
Well, I think it was the Washington Post that pointed out, you know, Graham has never been in a competitive general election before. he's had, you know, a bit of primary stuff, but never like this. And so he's not handling it well. He's reacting in a panicked way. And again, for that relatively new Carolina voter who's not a diehard conservative, is not bonded to Graham, you know, I thought perhaps the flip-flop of the judges, you know, who, South Carolina, why would they care? They want the judge. I mean, so those folks don't really want the judge that badly. They're not super left, but they're put off by the egregious flip-flop and now the panicky nature of the campaign. So it makes it plausible that he could win, but I think it's in conjunction with Biden playing it cool on these cultural issues and broadening that electorate geographically and ideologically. And if Democrats can keep that, I mean, that's the thing. They have to keep that model for the demographic element to work in their favor. So that's why I wrote the piece. Not that I think, I mean, it's not a given, you know, Biden could have a terrible presidency and things could tip the other way, but how do you beat the Electoral College? This is how, not by what some folks thought, you know, leaning hard to the left was going to accomplish.
You do it the old fashioned way, by winning. And yeah. I like that. And I like you, Bill Scheer. you're a mensch. Go watch Shareable, Scheerable on YouTube. Subscribe, click like if that's possible. Leave a comment. I saw last night you were live. Live.
I'm mostly doing these through live chats. And I think when you subscribe, you get pinged. And then you can be on the live chat and I can see what you're saying and I can respond to questions.
So you're like live streaming, you watching the debate, but there were people chiming in.
But even when I'm doing non-debate stuff, I'm doing it through, you know, I'm choosing the live stream function. So I'm not, you know, I'm not recording it separately, then uploading it and editing it. I'm just doing it straight. And when once I press the button and I'm live, I think when you subscribe, you get pinged because then people pop up in the live chat right away. And I can you know, mostly just give it a monologue, but I can do some engagement. I can answer questions.
I'm going to do a live stream of people watching me, watching you, watching the debate. That's meta.
Good to talk to you. We'll DM Zoom tomorrow.
Yeah.
And I may have a special guest on Shareable tomorrow too. So keep an eye out for that.
Special guest. I'm excited. All right. You can follow us on Twitter at DMZ Show. Support us on Patreon. Help us keep, as Adam Carolla says, keep the pirate ship afloat. Make Bill uncancelable.
Exactly.
Make him shareable. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you, Matt.
We'll be back in the DMZ.
All right.